Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for November 16th, 2023, live in your living room, and for the 23rd year on this same spot, Thursday evening, 6 p.m. Central Time from WWCR Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm talking a little bit soft tonight because I want my voice to end to get to the end of this show. It's been a little funny lately, maybe humidity in the air, who knows? But I'm going to be talking about green, the color green, and electricity in the universe, in outer space, etc. And of course, you always hear, when you hear about outer space, you hear about red, the red shift. And I might just mention that just a little bit tonight. Actually, a listener wrote in and asked about if I could talk about that, and then also my story about when I was teaching university level astronomy, which was interesting because I was actually teaching physics, and they came to me and they said, "Hey, you know about astronomy, can you teach astronomy?" And this was in a state university system, and so I said, but I knew I would have to teach out of a textbook because following the curriculum. And so that was real interesting because I had my own twist telling the students that, here's what they're teaching you and this is not true. And I actually made a video which is available on my website. You can see me as a much younger person. It was made in 1991, if you can imagine that. And it was called Astronomy for the 90s, and expose on astronomy at the time. And oddly enough, nothing has changed since. The standard scientific community is just as ignorant now as it was back then. But anyway, I'll be talking about the color green, electrical things in the universe, and it is a result of the hydrogen green line, and there's also an oxygen green line. And so you can see this, for example, when you see comets, you'll see, especially bigger ones that are naked eye visible, you will see the color green, and you often will see science articles in space.com or any of the other space information outlets where they're talking about green comets, very common. And it's the green hydrogen line in that case, but scientists still can't figure it out, of course. Because they don't know why there should be electrical things around comets when they are completely electrical, 100% electrical. Anyway, green comets. So anyway, I'll be talking about this. But first of all, a couple other topics. First, lately there's been a big push, and this has been going on for a long time, but now it just hit, hyperspace. The push to claim that global warming is the cause of everything. Your kids' shoelaces are not untied or untied. Oh, it's caused by global warming. There's going to be more of that. More people are going to die of heat. More people are dying of, innocent people are dying of bombs blowing up in Gaza, but nobody talks about that. They're talking about global warming, more people dying. Which is all fallacy. It's just a global warming thing. I heard again another prediction, a dire prediction, that in 6 years it's all over. We're all going to be dead. Well, I've heard that prediction 10 and 20 and 25 years ago, that only a few years out, it's all over. And people still will believe it. It's just like any like warmongering. They pulled off two wars in the same country in Iraq. They destroyed it two times in a 10-year period by the same family. The same yokel family was president. Two, father and son pulled off the same routine to go to war in Iraq, where there's a lot of oil, by the way. And but anyway, yeah, the general populace in the world, let alone United States, is not very intelligent. There's a few smart people floating around, and you can pick them out here and there, but far and wide. Intelligence is not ranking up there in one of the properties of modern people. Just want to mention Jupiter winds. The Jupiter winds are continuing. I think they're waning finally. But this past week, I did notice continuing action on the Jupiter winds. And the early November was the date when Jupiter and Earth were closely aligned electrically. But the Jupiter winds started way early in October this year. Just intense winds, straight line winds that lasted for days. And then it would stop for a day and then it would start again. And all over the planet. And they typically last for about a week or so. Not very long. But this year, they lasted for weeks after that close electrical alignment with Jupiter. So something else is going on. And I think they're finally waned. I noticed that yesterday. They were kind of like just not there anymore. You get some wind, which is normal. Wind is normal. But these kind of winds where they just go on for days, day and night for days, straight line winds, they're connected to the Jupiter electrical connection. And I've talked about that in particular. Another listener calling in about the Peapons Brooks comet, which has been rather famous in the last months. This is the one that develops the horns every now and then. And they say, oh, that's due to volcanoes. Well, it's absolutely absurd. They're perfectly symmetrical volcanoes on this comet, which is tumbling, by the way, and they know that. And the horns are always in the same direction relative to the sun. So, anyway, of course, another electrical phenomenon. Now, here's something. You think you have it bad. How would you like to be evacuated from your house with police helicopters hovering overhead to evacuate you in case of imminent eruption of a volcano under your house? Well, these people, around 4,000 people, living in this little hamlet in Iceland, were evacuated because the magma was coming up. And now I've been, many of you possibly have been to volcanic sites where you can walk on the lava and you can actually hear the lava flowing underneath your feet, you know, a short ways down. And that's pretty spooky. In fact, I was at a site one time and a tourist fell in, like actually broke through and I think lost a leg or something to the volcanic lava below, and they were able to drag this person out of there. But, you know, if you're around lava, just stay away. I mean, it is dangerous. You know, it is melted metals. That's how hot it is. And flowing, moving, and underneath, you know, you can, you know, it's like a thin crust, and you can fall through this. So anyway, but the 4,000 people evacuated because the magma, normally at 1,500 meters depth, was only at 800 meters and rising. What that meant is there was a lava current underground that was eating away the bedrock and coming up, and many earthquakes in that, like hundreds and hundreds of earthquakes at the time. So they were like, this baby's going to blow and take this whole town with it. So they evacuated the town, 4,000 residents, and they let them back in for a very short period of time where they could get their belongings, their pets, anything else they wanted to get out of there. And then this is the really strange part. They had police helicopters hovering overhead so that if this thing started to erupt, they could literally pick the people up off the ground and fly them out of there. Is that crazy? So just think you're sitting there, you know, sipping your coffee, listening to this show with the family. And by the way, next week, the family show I'll have Thanksgiving, a special show for Thanksgiving, because what happens is that people are visiting. And so the family sits down a lot of times to listen to my show, and the visitors hear me for the first time. So always on Thanksgiving, which is always on Thursday, which is the night for my show, I have this special show where I actually kind of talk to the new people and actually gain a lot of fans. People go, "I never knew this guy was out there." My show is not a big show, although I think probably a lot of places my name is a household word and has been for decades and decades. I talk to people all the time. "I followed you since you were on Art Bell in the 1990s, and so, but the there are people out there that have never heard of me and don't know who I am, and they're at Thanksgiving, and they sit down and the family is listening to me as they do every week, and this brings in some new listeners. So I try and make a show specifically to them. So that'll be next Thursday. But anyway, back to my point, that here's these 4,000 residents in Iceland who just have to pick up and leave. But the other thing is, these people probably built their homes there a long time ago, and it was deemed to be relatively safe. And how many people happen to know that there's a raging volcano underneath their house? It's probably not. It probably caused some warm weather. And they probably use what do you call it? Thermal heating, geothermal heating for their houses. That's very common in Iceland, a land that's very far north, ice and snow, yet it's very warm because just a little bit under the ground is this huge heat sink that's part of the volcanic system of Earth. And wow, that's just a free source of energy. Okay, so just going to mention something. There's a new product coming along that you should be aware of, and I'm not going to say any more than that right now. Just keep your ears up, your ears to the rail, so to speak. And I think it's very interesting. A lot of the things that I'm involved with came along naturally, like the wing generator generated other businesses, like selling shipping containers because of the big the large scale of the wing generator shipping stuff in shipping containers. And then all of a sudden I have access to shipping containers because in a lot of cases, it makes more sense to buy the container than to rent one, where you have to unload it and then ship the shipping container back. And a lot of times that's more expensive than just buying the container. So at any rate, just as a little businesses that pop up. This new product line actually will be one of those things. So interesting. Okay, so explain the 7-inch filter. Okay, this is really important. A lot of people still are learning the quality and the uniqueness of my filter line. Okay, so the 7-inch filter is very interesting in that it hangs down in the blower container. And so why is that? If you're used to this, is I'm talking about the gravity water filter elements. If you look at a standard water filter element, it sticks up into the upper container. There's two containers, typically stainless steel, could be plastic, one sitting on top of the other. You pour the water in the top container and it filters through the filter, and then it catches the good wa filtered water in the bottom container. Okay, so now you have clean water in the bottom container. But what happens in the upper container with those filter elements sticking up, as the water starts to go down and it's filtered and it goes through the filter element, Pretty soon, in fact, right away, almost immediately, the filter in the top of the filter is exposed to the air and it doesn't do anything. It's not filtering water anymore. So as the water level drops down, less and less of the filter is actually filtering water. So it turns out, if you do the math, so to speak, that about 80% of the water is only filtered through the bottom 10% of the filter. Now, when you come to think of it, now what's going on with this filter? If it's like a ceramic with a two-stage, where you've got the ceramic is the physical filter, and then inside is a medium which removes the chemicals, very little of that medium is actually ever used. In the top of the container, the ceramic filter, it's never used. And then you go to like the black cast filters. There are one stage. They don't even have a physical filter on them. There's just a single piece of stuff, whatever the stuff is. Looks like I call it packing foam. But it's only a medium, and the same situation applies, that the bottom part of that filter is the only part that's actually filtering anything. And it's really not filtering. It's an absorber. It's a misnomer that those black filters are a filter. They're not a filter. They're an absorber. And the majority of the water is only filtered through the bottom part. And in those cases, too, you have to prime them, which means you take bad water and you have to pump it backwards through the filter. So you're contaminating the filter from the inside before you even use it, which is pretty crazy. Especially if you're in an emergency situation, where are you going to get good water to pump backwards through your filter to activate it? That's because the material in those is called hydrophobic. It resists water. And so anyway, I could go on and on about that. But anyway, the design of my gravity water filter elements is very unique because they hang down. It's the only filter that hangs down. And so what happens? The water goes through that filter 100% of the time, all the time, through the entire filter. And so that there's also a physical filter, which is stage one, which is a modern material called ultrafiber. And then the stage two is a medium. And there's a lot more of it there than you find in any other filter. So it's really technologically a much, much better filter. And plus, it filters very quickly, so you don't need four of them. You only need one. One filter's worth about good for about 1,000 gallons. So for the average gravity filter user, 2 gallons a day, if you fill your gravity water filter every day, it's about 2 gallons. At 1,000 gallons, that's 500 days, or about a year and a half for one filter element. And at they're about $39 a piece on average, sold in 4 and 10 packs. But that means that a 4-pack is going to last you about 6 years. So it's really incredible. It's really incredible. Two of them would be a 3-year period, and then four of them would be a 6-year period. So it's just amazingly, you know, inexpensive. And my 4-pack's $189, includes shipping. 10-packs are $399, and they include shipping to the 50 states. We don't ship to Canada anymore. I've had just amazingly horrific situation with Canada, where they're charging these outrageous entry fees for products, and so they just can't ship there anymore, can't ship to foreign countries. So what people do, though, is they'll have it shipped to a border station. They go pick it up on the American side and take it across the border themselves. But anyway, we don't ship to Canada anymore. But life in the big city, after COVID, we started shipping to Canada, and then all of these high tariffs started. So no more shipping to Canada, unfortunately. But anyway, these are the best filters on the market and least expensive. Anyway, And if you've heard of this whole industry, it's been kind of thrown upside down lately because of some bad actors, let's just put it that way. Okay, so anyway, I wanted to just talk a little bit about that. So the 7-inch HI filters that we call them HIs, they're just the best. They're the least expensive, the most modern technology. That's the other thing that anybody, which I don't even call them competition, anybody out there is selling a water filter for gravity. They've been selling the same technology for 20 or 30 years in some cases. And so what mine have is just the latest technology. It's like buying an automobile. There's a lot of upgrades. There's a lot of improvements that have come along when you buy a new automobile over one that was sold even 10 years ago. But in the water filter industry, there are people selling technology that was made 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, in some cases. Anyway, okay, let me see if I have some other topics here. Okay, so this is at the request, by the way, upcoming too, not next week, but after, once we get into the Christmas season, I will spend at least part of a show talking about the Christmas star, which was a large comet. And it was up in the sky. It was a sign in the heavens that lasted for a long time, probably much more than a year. Like this Pepin's-Brooks comet is lasting quite a while. But anyway, there was something very specific and special about the Christmas star that the astrologers, the three kings, knew about and were waiting for. And when they saw it in the heaven, they packed up their bags, their camel trains, and yeah, they did not have Ferraris, and they didn't travel across super highways across the desert. They went by camel train and ended up meeting on the way. Very interesting story. But the Christmas star was very definitely a comet. And the reason I do this every year is because every year the litany of astronomers come chiming out that this was a planetary alignment or some nonsense. So to try and fight that nonsense, I talk about the real nature of the Christmas star. So that'll be coming up after, sometime after Thanksgiving. This listener wanted me to reiterate this story. I've told this before about when I was teaching astronomy at the university level, and the first semester I taught this, I taught it for probably 3 or 4 semesters. I'm not sure. There were quarters in the university system where I was. They were in quarters, and the first quarter had like 30 students, and this was an elective for science, and these were non-science students. So this was a science elective that they had to take something. So people signed up. Okay, so astronomy. And so then the second quarter, I had like 60 students, and ended up when I was teaching at the end, I had three sections with 90 students in the class, and that's where I did this study. You can see the study Astronomy for the 90s. It's a video that was professionally produced with funding from the university system, and you can see that on my webpage. It's one of the videos that's available. It's called Astronomy for the 90s. Okay, so here's the story that I'd come into class one day, in the middle of the term, and students are kind of like, not really interested, kind of bored, just kind of like maybe it was a nice day or something outside. They really didn't want to be there, and I'd kind of sense this. You kind of, as with the decades of experience teaching like I had at the university level, you just kind of read the students, And I'd say, okay, today we're going to do something a little bit different. Oh, okay, great. The students now, they kind of perked up. You got their interest because they were just kind of expecting a standard lecture and kind of bored. And so, okay, I'd say, today here we're going to do a little exercise. And I would say, okay, pick up something that was not here a week ago that is now here. Like you're driving down the road, there's a new construction going on, something that's new in the last week. And so what I'm I was gonna the whole story is about leading them down this path to where they making some realizations. Okay, so they first person would say, yeah, there's a new a fitness center that's being built down the street here or something, or a gas station or something. They're just breaking ground. Okay, that's something new. Well, let's go back a couple weeks. What's new that wasn't there before? And so the students would think of something, another student would say something, and then I'd go back a month, then I'd go back 2 months, then I'd go back 6 months, then a year, then 5 years, 10 years, okay, 50 years. What was n here then? What was not here that is here now? You know, oh, this whole town was just a little hamlet of 50 people 50 years ago. And now it's a thriving metropolis of 50,000 or something, you know. And this we'd go through this routine. Now we go back 100 years and 200 years and 500 years, 1,000 years, and then we're getting back to the point of, say, Marco Polo discovering the route, the overland route to the Silk Route to China, which had not been there. So they're discovering new civilizations. The European civilization is reaching out and discovering this Oriental civilization that they really didn't know about previously. And then, of course, the Vasco da Gama taking the sea route, and then Columbus looking for India across the Atlantic Ocean. And so, anyway, going back into history. And so eventually we'd go back to this story about the civilization, the origin of man, etc. And what they would realize is that as you go back in history, the Earth had all of these pockets of advanced civilizations that were totally separate. You know, they had the Orientals, which were separate from the Mongolians. The Mongolians, remember, developed and then invaded China, invaded everything. You had the Alexander the Great moving out and conquering, but encountering all of these civilizations that were really not well known about previously. You have the Persians back in the day expanding and conquering the world until finally the Greeks built up and defeated them in a massive war. But anyway, the whole point is that the history of man that is being taught could not possibly be true. And so these students, in doing this little exercise, would start to realize this. They go, well, wait a minute. This doesn't make sense. This is not what we were taught. And it was this little exercise which allowed them to realize this. And every time they would get to the point where they'd realize this, and some student would say, well, wait a minute. This doesn't match what we were taught. This, what we were taught, couldn't possibly be true. And the other students, yeah, that's what's going on here, you know. And I said, okay, very good. And they would get mad. This is the thing. They weren't just discovering this, they were seriously angry that here they are at the university level and were taught this complete malarkey, baloney, malarkey in Irish lingo, which I'm a little bit like 100% Irish. This complete baloney about the history of man, and the students would get upset. And I said, very good. I said, now go to the library. Your assignment is to come back tomorrow and go to the library and find out what the real story is. Okay, so they come back the next class, and they're really mad because they go, this what's patently obvious, what we discovered here just by a thought process, like a Gedanken experiment, is that everything we've been taught about the history of man could not possibly be true. It's just a big lie. So now they were really mad. Okay, so this was the story of what I did with my astronomy students. And then also along with it, astronomy came into play because everything that astronomers were telling about the history of man relative to Earth was false too. I mean, this whole history of man thing, where these civilizations were fairly developed, fairly unique, and completely isolated on planet Earth. And as they developed and grew, the ancient Greeks grew, etc., they didn't know about China. You know, they had no idea that China was over there, that Peru was there with the Incas. They had no knowledge of that. The Native Americans that lived in their own little world, and the Western Hemisphere was totally populated. This idea that man came across the Bering Strait, you know, migrating from Mesopotamia, and that's how all of these civilizations evolved, or the little pygmy back people in Africa, and the tall, very tall, or the very heavy set Africans, or the, you know, the Chinese, or the Mongolians, or the Greeks, or the, you know, the Aztecs or the Mayans. The histories that go way back that are totally separate development. So this idea that man developed in Mesopotamia and all of the civilizations of the world developed from that in 7,000 years is just, it's bizarre. I mean, whoever made that up didn't think very much, as it couldn't possibly be true, given what just basics of what we know about the development of man. Okay, so anyway, the students would get very upset. And now their day of being lackadaisical changed because they realized that now they still, and here's the thing, once you open the door to people and they realize they've been had, now they start looking in other places. They start looking around at this and that story and the causes of wars and, you know, all of the other things that, you know, you accept from the news media. All of this becomes obvious that it's just crap that they're teaching to the public every day on a daily basis. Okay. Maybe I should get this other little story in at the same time. I do this also with these astronomy students and sometimes to my physics classes or mathematics classes. Okay, so I would come in and I'd say, okay, I'm going to give a lecture today, and a special lecture was on whatever the topic was, and I would purposely fill it with things so it just crazy off the wall, couldn't possibly be true things, you know, and very simple things. And so the students, I'd say, okay, at the end of the lecture, we're going to give a test to see how your retention is, you know, to test your ability to think. And so I would intentionally insert just stupid stuff. And they were writing notes. And okay, now let's have a test. And I would test them on this baloney stuff. And they would just feed it back to me like, Johnny, be good. And so the next day I'd come in with the papers and they were, you know, F, F, F. And they were like, what do you mean? I told you exactly what you told me. I said, yeah, that's the problem. I said, that's the problem. Yeah, you listen to what I said and look at it. This is stupid. You really believe this? And they were, well, you're the professor. You're the one that's supposed to be teaching us. I said, well, wait a minute. No. You're the students. You're supposed to be the ones that are learning how to think and discern things. And so I said, today we're going to try this again. And so I would give them a lecture, and I said, now you got to think. And they would get mad. They were like, what do you mean, think? Because they had been trained through their whole education. If they just repeated what the teacher said and put it on the paper, they would get an A. And so I tried to break that cycle, and I said, you know, that doesn't work with me. You have to think. And so then I'd give another lecture, and I'd say, okay, now we're going to test you again. And at that point, they were like, well, you know, you're telling us bad information. I said, yeah, you got to figure it out. It doesn't make any sense according to principles of physics or something else. You have to figure that out as a student. Don't just believe everything everybody tells you. And all of a sudden, you know, but some students would object that they were like, you can't make us think, is what they were saying. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Okay, now I'm going to talk about green things glowing. And so this piqued my interest. The other day I saw an article on green, it's called air glow, and it happens at Mars, it happens at Earth. And in Venus, by the way, the air glow is in X-rays, which is interesting. But the air glow that's around Earth and Mars, and you see this, it's very faint. But it goes back in history, and way back you find the ancients talking about this phenomena on a very dark night. And of course, the ancients, they didn't have street lights. They didn't have, lighting like we have today around cities. And so they were much more tuned to the night sky. And so you have a night where there's no moon. So it should be really, really dark. In fact, there's Pliny the Elder around 100 BC talks about it. He was a Roman army general, and he talks about this effect with the night sky, where you can actually see very well. And of course, general in the army would want to know about this because, you know, they might choose to fight at night, where that would give them an advantage and a disadvantage to the opponent. But at any rate, they noticed this green glow in the atmosphere. And of course, nobody knew about what caused it back then, but they just observed it. And so now satellites are able to look at the Earth and Mars from the dark side, from in the shadow. So all you can see is the sun is blocked out, which and the moon. And so you see this green glow up in certain areas, like around the poles. You'll find a ring. It's called the ring current. And it's due to the part of the plasma magnetic field of Earth coupling with high energy particles that are coming in. It's an electrical current. And high energy particles, protons coming in from the sun, meet up with this, causing a green glow. And so there's another location, green comets. I've already talked about them in this show, where the green comets are green because of the hydrogen light. Now, this is an interesting thing, that both hydrogen and oxygen have green lines, a line being a spectral line. In other words, when some phenomena happens, they emit green light at a very specific wavelength. So they're called the green lines. But hydrogen has a very specific one, and that's the one that's involved with comets. And so you see, like, for example, Comet Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, or other comets that showed a green halo. And this is like a perfectly circular halo. That is the Debye shielding caused by hydrogen ions. So it's a hydrogen molecule ionized, and singly ionized, and it gives off this green light. So it's a glow to the point where you can actually see it, but of course standard science cannot explain it because they don't know about the electric field of the comet. They think it's a dirty snowball, and so there's no reason for some kind of green glowing circle around a dirty snowball, but don't tell that to anybody in the standard science industry. Industry. It's not a subject. It's an industry, where an industry is a for-profit entity. And the astronomy industry does not recognize that because it's not good for their paycheck. Okay. Anyway, green tornadoes. I'll just read all of these off. Air glow, which is the atmosphere glowing green, and that's due to the Earth being involved in this electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. Then you have green comets, which is the same phenomena because Earth is acting like a comet, and green comets are discharging the solar capacitor. And they have this instead of an atmosphere, they have a shielding, electrical shielding of hydrogen that is glowing in the that green hydrogen line. Green tornadoes. Now, when tornadoes are seen at night, you will see this green color coming from them. And there are people who have had tornadoes go right over the top of them, and they look up and they see this green color. and electricity. They see a lot of electricity inside the tornado. And so, in fact, if you look at a tornado at night, it's lighting up like a light bulb, in typically green. And so that's the oxygen and hydrogen lines. Green auroras, so the ring current of the Earth, this is near the North and South Pole, where you have auroras. Excuse me. You have auroras that are like ring currents, and glowing in the green also. That's typically how you see them. Then sprites, elves, and jets. These are above clouds. Green. Mars atmosphere. Green at night. When you look at it with a satellite at night, you can see the air glow. The same situation as Earth, and it's the color green. And now the last one on my list here, there's more, would be rockets going through the ionosphere. And I talked about this recently on some shows, where the atmosphere is glowing green as these rocket plumes come up through the ionosphere. They discharge it, and the electrical current caused by the discharge creates a green glow. Okay, so there's some discussion in the scientific community as to what is the cause of the green light. And some say that it is due to oxygen, where two oxygen atoms combine to create oxygen O2, the molecule, and gives off a green light in this, has a spectral line, green spectral line in this process. Okay, but that is not the process what we're dealing with the Debye shielding of comets, this globe of hydrogen. You can actually see that it's hydrogen. There's more ways to detect that it's hydrogen than just the green line. Let me talk about shielding just for a minute here. Say you take into outer space and you have a charged particle, and this is one of the difficult things of understanding charge in outer space, is how do you get something charged in outer space? Well, these are thought processes. These are thought experiments. And so how do you get it charged? I'll talk about that in a minute, how the actual process works. But say you could have something charged in outer space that maintains its charge. Very quickly, other charge, if it's a negatively charged object, like a comet nucleus, very quickly, like within a New York second, charged particles of the opposite type, the positive charged particles, would come in and neutralize it. That's why in Chapman physics, what is known as Chapman physics, that doesn't believe in electrical conditions in outer space, that's why they believe there could not be any charged objects in outer space. And it's, in a sense, it's true. But what they don't realize is that the charging process is part of the solar engine. The solar engine, fusion engine, is creating electrical charge, separating that charge, and then there's an excess current of protons in the solar wind that creates a big capacitor, the solar capacitor. And when that discharges, it has a tremendous amount of stored energy. And so when a comet nucleus comes in, or the Earth, or the planets, or the moons, or anything in outer space is discharging that solar capacity. So that is the source of electrical energy. And when the discharge occurs, something I learned back in my Cornell days, when I was putting all this together, the scientific information with my theoretical work, in any discharge, the electrons turn out to be the majority charge carrier. In the discharge, the positive current is the minimal. It's by factors of thousands, if not a hundred thousands. The electrons are the primary charge carrier. So you have this electrical discharge coming out from the sun in the form of electrons. And it's like this nucleus, or the Earth, or the Jupiter, or whatever, is like a rock in a stream of this electrical discharge, and it always occurs where the planet is. And the example I use for that in my, if you read my books, is like the backyard bug killer. You have these electrically high voltage plates surrounding a light, so the bug comes flying in trying to get to the light and flies through this mesh of wire. The outer one is at ground potential, so you don't kill yourself if you touch this thing, and then the inner one is at a very high potential, but it's not enough to break down the dielectric of the air that's in the atmosphere. But when the bug flies in, it's enough to break down that electric field, and so the bug discharges the capacitor, and the current always goes where the bug is, and it kills the bug. It's called the backyard bug killer. People call it a zapper. But the solar system is doing the same thing, and so the electrical discharge is always where the object is, whether it's Jupiter, Earth, the comet nucleus, piece of dust, you know, Elon Musk's car, whatever, is in outer space, is discharging these local capacitors. And Earth has 17 of them around Earth. I explain this in my weather book. So 17, I call them local electrical batteries. They're plasma batteries. They're capacitors. And when something comes into these capacitors, it can discharge the capacitor, causing, and that's why people cannot fly through the Van Allen belt, because they're relativistic electrons and protons that when they hit metal, they cause X-rays, and that's the X-ray dosage that's so out of this world that it would kill people if they tried to go through it. And that's why NASA never ever goes there. They're talking about going to Mars, they're going to go to the moon, everybody's going to the moon, going to Mars in 20 years. Why 20 years? Because all the people working on that thing will be retired in the golf course in Arizona in 20 years, and they don't have to match up to the fact that they can't do it. So anyway, that's a big scam too. As I say, the astronomy aerospace industry. I mentioned this the other day on a radio show. I said, how many aerospace executives have been in outer space? If the industry were about getting into outer space, all these aerospace executives would be the first ones to be there. How many have ever gone into space? And the answer is zero. They're there to make the money. They're not there to go into outer space. The last thing they want to do is to go into outer space, because then they have to actually do something. So a 20 or 30 year program is really slick, because you're going to be retired on that course. You know, the kids will be through college. The house will be paid for. You buy your retirement home. You'll be on the golf course, and all of that baloney that you fed to the public to get your big salary over those 20 to 30 years will be coming to you in a pension and just fat city, you know. So don't rock the boat, buddy, because you could lose all of that. So that's the aerospace, astronomy, space science industry in a nutshell. That's the best way to understand it. Okay, so anyway, back to the color green. I think the comet green is one of the most interesting ones, because, you know, where does a dirty snowball comet get a color green halo around it that's maybe 100,000 miles in diameter? Well, it's ridiculous. You know, there's no explanation for it, and they don't even try. That's the funny part about it. It's like a major characteristic of comets, this green ball that forms around the comet nucleus. They don't even try and explain it. But it's one of the most beautiful ones because it's big. Comet Holmes was bigger than the full moon. So you know how big the full moon is up in the sky. And I saw it with my own eyes. It was naked eye visible for a number of nights. And by the way, Comet Holmes, I predicted the explosive nature of that comet, because it was in alignment with Earth and Mars. Interestingly enough, Comet Holmes entered into the electrical discharges of Mars and Earth that were combining at the time. And on that given night, boom, just like clockwork, Comet Holmes went from a little comet to this huge comet. And what you were seeing there was the hydrogen Debye shielding cloud, this perfect sphere. And the nucleus, relatively small, of course. So this is a gas cloud that forms, and what it's doing is doing exactly what it's supposed to do, shielding that nucleus. So outside of that shield, and this is something that people don't understand, too, about electric fields in outer space, is they're shielded. And they don't go very far. The concept of electricity is that the electric field goes to infinity. But in outer space, it's not true, because they become shielded. And so if they become shielded, they become neutralized very quickly. So the only way you can keep this process going is if there's some source of electrons to keep that nucleus charged on a continual basis, and that's where the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor comes in. So this is fairly complicated physics, and this is just the surface level. This is not getting down deep into a lot of these processes and charge to mass ratios and other things of, you know, dust particles, etc. Or, you know, ions, dust particles, hydrogen nuclei, you know, ionized hydrogen, water, where, you know, you see one of the major components of comets. Excuse me, I'm kind of losing my voice here. I hope I can get to the end. That, excuse me, comets, one of the main components in the tail is water. So that's why they think comets are dirty snowballs, because this water, they say, is coming off the nucleus. Well, if you get close to a comet nucleus, there's no water. There's no water coming off the nucleus. In fact, I talked to the chief scientist, a woman, from the European Space Agency on the Rosetta mission. I said, what's the closest to the nucleus that you actually detected water? She said 10 kilometers. So within about 6 miles of the nucleus, they never detected a single molecule of water. So where's all this water that's coming off the nucleus? Well, it's absurd. And they know it. These scientists know it, but they can't say anything. That's the bizarre part. One of the lead scientists from the European Space Agency at the Paris Air Show, talking about the Rosetta mission, kind of put his head down and he kind of mumbled it, but he said, basically, here's what he said, paraphrasing, that he had published many papers in his scientific history dealing with the dirty snowball comet model. He said, but that's not true. He said, he basically admitted that the dirty snowball comet model could not possibly explain what they saw at this comet. It was a dry nucleus. There was nothing coming off of it. There was no water. They did not find a single molecule of water. They found organic dust. It was like a grains of sand made of organic material, which would include oxygen as a component and hydrogen as a component in the molecular structure, but no water, not a drop of water, yet you see at a distance this water tail. So the water is coming in, and what's going on there is that the hydrogen and oxygen are combining to form water. That's one of the primary components, plus hydrocarbons, carbon and hydrogen forming to make the many different hydrocarbon chains, nitrogen, hydrogen, ammonias, ammonia-related molecules being formed in the comet tail as this material is being drawn in to the comet nucleus by electrical forces, and that's what a comet is. And the color green is a result of the hydrogen green line, and you can see it. When you look at a green comet, look at the hydrogen green line, and that's what it is. There's no question. It's a very specific green color. You don't need a spectrometer to know that it's the hydrogen green line that is the Debye shielding of the comet nucleus. But of course, like I say, with standard science, they can't think. It's not thinking is not allowed. Putting down on a piece of paper what exactly is expected of you is what is allowed, and that's what's fed to the public. And believe me, the people in Tier 1 science know my work, and they know that it's correct. So you have, like, for example, you go to an American Geophysical Union meeting, 20,000 scientists from around the world. These are the Tier 2 scientists. There's a few Tier 1 scientists that go to these things, but the Tier 1 scientists know that everything I do is correct. They've come out and told me. But the Tier 2 scientists are often la-la land, and these guys shuffle around every year. They write their papers, they get their publications, they get their little grant money, and they're the window dressing on science, just like Congress is the window dressing of government, to make people think that there's real government going on. That's just, it's but like I say, people are not too bright. Anyway, sorry for that diversion. But anyway, green, once again, the list of things that are electrically green: airglow, green comets, green tornadoes, green auroras, green sprites, elves, and jets above clouds, green atmosphere at Mars, and green trailing, where rockets are going through the upper ionosphere, a green color that forms as those plumes discharge the vertical electric field up in the ionosphere and cause a green color. And you can see these, especially before twilight. If these rockets are going off at night, which more and more are going off at night, you can see this. Okay. So anyway, about 1 minute left here in my show. Just to remind you, go to the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. I have the best water filters on the planet. They have the best deal. The MR5 whole house water filter is the it's the premier filter, broad spectrum filter for all of the water in your house, hot and cold. I also sell a nationally NSF certified PFAS filter if you have a PFAS issue. Those are now available. And the 7-inch filters that I was talking about before, the HI filter elements for gravity replacement, those are sold in 4 and 10 packs. A 4 pack is $189, includes shipping. A 10 pack is $399. Also have the sink filter, beautiful stainless steel sink filter, and then the MR5, which is the flagship product of the company. Also visit my page at jmccsci.com, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McKenney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.